Today, Chaos City, the Property Imperative Weekly to the 3rd of August 2019. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And today we review the past week's events, which were, to say the least, somewhat chaotic. The Fed cut the cash rate, but only by 25 basis points, and signalled that this was only a minor insurance adjustment. Trump talked about imposing yet more trade tariffs on China, despite the current talks. And there was more bad news from Europe, and here in Australia, there were mixed signals, with some home prices slightly up, but retail, income, and inflation data telling a different story, and the credit impulse eased some more. Plus, the Treasury released a draft of its plan to restrict cash-based transactions, so once again, loads to get through. And we're going to start with the international scene, but if you want to jump directly to the local news, then the time is shown below. And I'm also going to add some times in for some of the main topics that we'll be covering as requested. In the US, it was a down week on the markets. Stocks fell for a fifth straight day on Friday, with the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ Composite suffering their worst weekly losses since the depths of the December slump. And late in the day, some buying kicked in after President Donald Trump reportedly softened his threat slightly to impose 10% tariffs on Chinese exports to the United States in September if there is proof that China is buying US agriculture and other products. That said, the S&P 500 was down 0.73% on the day, ending at 2,932. The NASDAQ Composite was down 1.32% to 8,004, and the Dow Jones Industrials fell 0.37%, having been as low as 311 points down earlier in the day, and ended at 26,485. The S&P and NASDAQ declines were their fifth in a row, and the Dow's decline was its fourth straight. The S&P 500 finished down 3.1% for the week, the NASDAQ dropped 3.9%, and the Dow's decline was 2.6% over the week. The week's declines were triggered after Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell suggested that the Fed's quarter-point rate cut might be a one-time event. And you can watch our show, The Fed Cuts, but a mid-policy adjustment only, for full analysis of the decision and its implications. And then on Thursday, in a series of tweaks, Trump said he would slap 10% tariffs on $300 billion of US-Chinese imports starting on September the 1st, saying that he was unsatisfied with the pace of trade negotiations between the two superpowers. Some $250 billion of Chinese imports are already subject to a 25% duty aimed at pressurizing the world's second biggest economy to strike a trade deal. Interestingly, he also tweeted that the US looks forward to continuing the positive dialogue with China on a comprehensive trade deal. The tariff announcement was probably a response to the high-level trade talks in Shanghai this week, where China likely showed little movement. The Commerce Ministry warned of retaliation on Friday. China strongly opposes and will take necessary measures to defend its interests if the US imposes an additional 10% tariff on $300 billion of Chinese imports, they said. And this threw the Federal Reserve yet another curved ball that may force the central bank to cut interest rates more than it had hoped was necessary to protect the US economy from trade policy risks. The Federal Reserve actually appears to be bailing out the president. The central bank is essentially signaling it's now the administration's insurer of last resort. There were more market falls, which continued into Friday, until the report Trump perhaps had softened his view if there's real agricultural buying, although White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow downplayed that report. The focus on trade totally overwhelmed any market reaction to the Labour Department's report that the economy added 164,000 jobs in July. The unemployment rate was unchanged at 3.7%. Payroll gains have slowed, but most economists said the results were solid. Then again, from an equity perspective, solid economic numbers can bring out the sellers as it hurts the chances for future interest rate cuts, and the markets are baying for more cuts. Apple dropped because it depends so much on access to the Chinese market for new business and because most of its products are manufactured in China. They would potentially be hurt by a new round of tariffs. The shares were down 2.12% to 204.02 on the day and subtracted 29 points from the Dow. Apple is trying to derive more of its revenue from service after years of heavy reliance on iPhone sales, which declined 12% in the most recent quarter. But the Apple credit card, which is being launched with Goldman Sachs, will not allow the purchase of cryptocurrencies with the card, according to a customer agreement posted on Goldman's website on Friday. The card cannot be used to purchase cash advances or cash equivalents, including cryptocurrencies, casino gaming chips, racetrack wagers, or lottery tickets. Apple and Goldman are not alone in banning the purchase of cryptocurrency, such as Bitcoin, with credit cards. Major American and British bank, Lloyd Bank Group, and Virgin Money banned such purchases last year, following the lead of US banking giants JP Morgan Chase and Citigroup. The banks were concerned that volatile prices would leave consumers saddled with debts they could not repay. Interest rates were lower, with the 10-year Treasury yield falling to 1.843, down 0.63%, while the three-month closed at 2.061%, down 0.14%, again signalling the yield curve inversion, which flags recession ahead. Fed funds futures now imply that traders see an 81.9% chance the Fed will lower rates again in September, up from less than 50% late on Wednesday. As one key analyst put it, the key word is uncertainty. Uncertainty acts like the Fed tightening. It raises risk premiums and stymies activity, full stop. The volatility index, though, was down 1.46% to 1761. Gold was up 1.45% to 1,453 in a flight to quality, while crude oil prices recovered from a big sell-off on Thursday to 55.23, up 2.73%. The US dollar index futures was down 0.28% at 97.87, and it's increasingly likely that the trade conflict will drag on for a long time and possibly well into next year. China's strategy seems to be to prepare for a long trade war and maybe wait it out until the other side of the election in 2020. China believes it has the tools to stabilize the economy through stimulus to compensate for the trade drag, and it is very likely that we'll see new stimulus announced soon. Chinese household debt has continued to rise rapidly, reaching 85% of disposable income at the end of 2018, according to Fitch Ratings. Rising debt servicing costs do not pose near-term risks to financial stability, but will weigh on economic growth in the medium term, they said. Chinese household debt grew by 18.2% last year, slightly slower than in 2017, but still nearly double the rate of nominal GDP growth. They estimate that household debt rose to about 53% of GDP last year, up from just 18% a decade earlier. This increase was largely driven by mortgage borrowing, but has spread to other products such as credit cards, where the outstanding balance of debt was similar to the US dollar at about $1 trillion at the end of 2018. The household debt to disposable income ratio is lower than most developed markets, but the gap will narrow rapidly, with the ratio rising to close to 100% at the end of this decade if growth remains unchecked. The rapid pace of household debt growth is more of a concern than the level. And China's Purchase Managers Index data for July this week was slightly better than expected, pointing to some stabilization, but at a subdued growth level. There is still no sign of a hard landing, though, which is the same signal from the metals markets that have held up reasonably well. Profit growth is hovering around zero due to the economic slowdown. And the property market will not be used for stimulus, though. Instead, measures will be taken that fit the long-term goal of growth, driven by high-end manufacturing, technology, private consumption, and services. Further, monetary easing is expected to weaken the Chinese yuan against the US dollar after a period of stabilization. The Shanghai Composite Index was down 1.41% on Friday to end at 2,872. The US dollar yuan was at 6.9405, up 0.63%. And by the way, that ailing bank we reported on last week, the Bank of Jizhou, has sold a portion of their domestic shares to ICBC Financial Asset Investment Co. That's a wholly owned subsidiary of Industrial and Commercial Bank of China. Cinda Investment Co., a wholly owned subsidiary of China Cinda Asset Management Co., and China Great Wall Asset Management Company. According to Bank Jinhu's announcement, the transactions were conducted with the support and guidance of the local government and the financial supervising authorities. As Moody's said, although Bank of Jinhu's share sale and Baoshang Bank's takeover may alleviate market fears of contagion risks and stabilize the bank's credit quality, they will not fundamentally improve the financial standing of regional banks, many of which remain weak links in China's financial system. In addition, the sale of the shares of some of Bank of Jinhu's original shareholders, although conducted at quite a deep discount to the bank's last traded share price before the trading suspension and book value, could increase the risk of moral hazard. European stock indices dived by as much as 2% on Friday as US President Donald Trump's warning of new tariffs on China sank stock markets worldwide and sent trade-sensitive sectors like mining and car makers into a tailspin. That sent the pan-European Stoxx 600 down 1.9% to a six-week low to 378.15. And UBS Global Wealth Management wrote, "The announcement will only serve to create additional downward pressure on business confidence. If businesses stop hiring as a result, this would greatly increase the risk of a recession." And most of Europe's main markets were set for their worst week since a slide in May, when a sudden breakdown in trade talks between the two countries hampered markets. A rally since then had been fueled by hopes that major central banks would adopt looser monetary policy to offset the trade war's impact on growth. But the European Central Bank and the US Federal Reserve both disappointed investors last month with stances that were more cautious than expected. Corporate earnings for the second 3 months of the year continue to pour in. French lender Crédit Agricole slipped 5.3% after it said that a weak performance at its corporate and investment unit had weighed on its profits. And German insurer Allianz fell 2.7% and was among the biggest drags on the Stoxx 600, despite posting a better than expected quarterly net profit and confirming its full year profit target. As much as $13.64 trillion, equal to 25% of all sovereign and corporate bonds, currently have negative yields, meaning investors are paying the issuer for the pleasure of holding their debt. And last week, in fact, German bunds touched new record lows on manufacturing weakness due to global headwinds, such as trade tensions and Brexit. And the 10-year bund yield dropped to minus 0.48%. Germany's preliminary purchasing managers index hit 43.1, down sharply from 45 in June and a 7-year low. Output slipped to 44.1, its steepest decline since 2009. Ongoing president of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, called Europe's economic outlook worse and worse, signalling a rate cut next month, as well as possible new rounds of quantitative easing. It's getting worse and worse in manufacturing especially, and it's getting worse and worse in those countries where manufacturing is very important, Draghi said. The euro-US dollar was up 0.23% to 1.1117. And finally, with the FTSE down 2.34% on Friday to 7,407, echoing the international concerns plus the latest on Brexit, where £2 billion has been put aside to prepare for a no-deal Brexit, and there was a narrowing of the government's working majority. Speculation about an early election is rife. The UK Financial Services Index fell 2.53% to 725.18, and in addition, the Bank of England warned a non-deal Brexit could drop UK growth significantly, and they left the cash rate at 0.75%. They said that looking through recent volatility, underlying growth appears to have slowed since 2018 to a rate below potential, reflecting both the impact of intensifying Brexit-related uncertainties on business investment and weaker global growth on net trade. Evidence from companies up to the middle of July suggests that uncertainty over the United Kingdom's future trade relationships with the European Union has become more entrenched. The labour market remains tight. Annual pay growth has been relatively strong. Consumer spending has remained resilient, and the CPI inflation was 2% in June, and core CPI inflation was 1.8%. The pound US dollar was at 1.2158, up 0.22%, but still down 1.88% over the week. And Bitcoin was up again to 10,510, up 0.58%, and up 6.78% over the week, but down 12.3% over the month. Analysts are divided as to whether these movements are reflecting simple volatility trading or something else. And we continue to regard it as purely speculative and by no means a safe haven. And so to the local scene. Last Friday, the Treasury released a draft bill to restrict cash transactions above $10,000 as part of its Black Economy Task Force. While fixing tax leakage and money laundering are laudable aims, their focus, we think, should be on larger corporations, property transactions, and the role of the big accounting firms rather than cash transactions. But more directly, this is misdirection, as the true agenda is to set the scene for negative interest rates down the track, as discussed in a recent IMF paper. The draft came out late on a Friday, and there's only a limited review period being allowed. Another signal. I discussed this important issue with John Adams in the Interests of the People channel. Red Alert, ScoMo declares war on the Australian people. A post, which, by the way, has received a record 62,000 views in just 3 days, and I followed it up with a discussion with Robbie Barwick from the CEC on the DFA channel, the real issues behind the cash ban, which has already received more than 17,000 views within the first 24 hours. We see this as a question of civil liberties, which are being eroded in a heavy-handed manner, and we encourage viewers to watch these shows and make your views known via the email address blackeconomy@treasury.gov.au. Mainstream media hardly reported this at all. And watch for our next IOTP post, in which we'll be discussing deposit bail, and it's all connected. Woolworths Holdings announced on Thursday that it will book an impairment of $437.4 million against David Jones, reducing the valuation of the department chain to around $965 million. This write-down is the second since 2018. Woolworths Holdings bought the prestigious network of stores in 2014 for $2.1 billion. A Woolworths spokesperson said this write-down reflects sustained and unprecedented economic pressures and structural changes in the Australian market. The retail sector in Australia is currently in recession, and the Australian economy has slowed to its weakest level since the global financial crisis in 2009. And the ABS said that the trend estimate for Australian retail turnover rose just 0.2% in June 2019, and that follows a rise of 0.2% in May and a rise of 0.2% in April 2019. In June, Victoria rose 0.3%, Queensland 0.4%, South Australia 0.3%, the ACT 0.4%, Tasmania 0.3%, and the Northern Territories 0.2%. But New South Wales and Western Australia was relatively unchanged in trend terms in June. That means our biggest state showed no retail growth at all last month. That's a shocker. Households are not spending. And the official statistics say that inflation is just 1.6%, while the rate of wage growth is 2.3%. We got new data on both dimensions this past week. The ABS reported that the CPI rose 0.6% in the latest quarter and is at 1.6% for the year, well below the RBA target. The most significant price rises in the June quarter were automotive fuels up 10.2%, medical and hospital services up 2.6%, especially private healthcare premiums. International holiday and travel and accommodation was up 2.7% and tobacco was up 2.4%. Inflation varied across the major centres. In Sydney, we saw a large rise in fuel costs, putting the result in the same range as being experienced by Perth and Darwin. And there were some offsets like cheaper bananas and, believe it or not, housing costs, which fell, though of course this is more reflecting rents, which are falling in some centres overall. There is little to suggest more than more RBA rate cuts ahead. On the income front, the release of the 17th wave of Australia's Household Income and Labour Dynamics Survey, HILDA for short, reveals that despite what the official statistics may say, and we've discussed this before, that they're pretty inaccurate, people were right to feel they are going backwards. It finds that for the thousands of households it interviewed, real disposable income grew strongly during the first 9 years of the survey, between 2001 and 2009. But then after the global financial crisis, for the 8 years between 2009 and 2017, results released today showed that growth stalled. And you can watch our post, Real Disposable Income Has Stalled Since 2009, for more on this. No wonder more households are feeling financially stressed. And the latest data from both APRA and the RBA shows that lending growth continues to slow to a record low level. So looking at the RBA credit aggregates to June 2019, total credit for housing was down well below 4% on an annualised basis. Owner-occupied housing grew at 4.9%. Credit for investor housing grew at just 0.5%, and that's a very low level, as you can see from the trend. Personal credit fell, down 3.5% over the last 12 months. And business credit was also weaker. And that gives us a total 12-month growth rate of just 3.3%. And that's the lowest level we've seen for a very, very long time. It's also just worth noting that the broad money was also a little higher compared with a few months back. And that is partly a reflection of our international trade position. Now, we can also look at the banks versus non-bank situation. And we can start by showing the change of both owner-occupied and investment lending for the major banks. We can then overlay the non-banks, and non-bank lending grew at a rate of 14.5% for owner-occupied borrowing and for investors at 8.5%, both much, much higher than for the main banks, the ADIs. And so this continues the trend where effectively a lot of the growth in the system is being funded from the non-bank sector. And that particular sector of the market is less well regulated. They're able to fund from private investors and other sources, as well as deposits. And we think in some cases they are writing more risky business. That's a leading indicator of risk ahead in our view. As Damien Boy from Credit Suisse put it, private sector credit was materially softer than expected, barely rising 0.1% in June, with downward revisions for prior month's data. June year-ended growth has slowed to 3.3% from 3.6%. Compositionally, weakness in business and personal credit lines underpin the downside surprise, and the story here seems to be about global uncertainties weighing on business confidence and a distinct lack of consumer confidence. And he went on to say, credit growth is a key driver of earnings for domestic cyclical and financial companies in the stock market. The downside surprise in credit growth is a near-term problem for earnings. Although he is actually more bullish ahead. Interestingly, the credit impulse in Australia seems to be hanging in there even as private sector credit growth deaccelerates. And the rise in trade, combined with less fiscal austerity, seems to be matching the effects of slower credit creation. We'll see. Auction clearance rates were strong again, but on very low volumes, so this should not be overemphasised. Sydney reported 75.7% and Melbourne 71.7%, with total auctions of 1,124 compared with 1,536 this time last year. And of course, more are not being reported at all, suggesting a positive bias in the numbers. The July home price index was slightly higher, according to CoreLogic. Sydney was up 0.2% along with Melbourne and Brisbane. Hobart was up 0.3%, but Adelaide, Perth and Canberra all fell in the month. The combined capital cities was up 0.1%. The combined regions fell 0.2%. And there are still considerable variations across the states and regions, with regional Western Australia down 34.6% since peak, Hobart down 0.8% from peak, and regional Tasmania at peak. All sectors are slowing movement, with the upper quartile the most in motion. But rental growth remains weaker, falling 0.1% in July and rising just 0.6% over the year, with Sydney's rents down 2.4% over the past 12 months. That's one reason why investors are not re-engaging. CoreLogic concluded, although the trend towards a recovery in housing values is relatively fresh and centred within the larger cities, there is no sign of a V-shaped recovery. The ongoing tightness in housing credit is expected to keep a rapid rebound in housing values at bay, despite the lowest mortgage rates since the 1950s. And this is one reason why we believe there is a risk of a bull trap, where people buy in thinking prices are recovering, but then they reverse again. I discussed this with Auto Capital's Tony LeContro. See our post, Watch Out for the Bull Trap. And we can also look at the latest movements using the CoreLogic Index daily data series. In Sydney, they rose 0.1% over the last week. They've fallen 0.18% over the last quarter. They've dropped 9% annually. And from the peak, they're at 14.7%. In Melbourne, prices rose 0.06% over the last week. Over the last quarter, they were at 0.03%. Over the last year, they're down 8.2%, and from peak, 10.8%. In Brisbane, they're down 0.06% over the last week, down 0.74% over the last quarter, down 2.4% over the last year, and down 2.4% from the last peak. In Adelaide, they fell 0.09% over the last week. They fell 0.64% over the last quarter. They fell 0.8% over the last year. And they're down 1.3% from peak. And in Perth, they were down 0.15% over the last week, down 2.3% over the last quarter, down 8.9% over the last year. And from peak, a massive 20.2%. And so putting all that together, across the five major centres, over the last week prices rose 0.05%. Over the quarter they fell 0.45%. Over the last year they dropped 7.5%. And from peak prices have fallen on average 10.7%. And we can also look at the annual movements on a daily basis using the CoreLogic series. Prices in Sydney have been moving just a little higher since early May. A little bit of a similar track in Melbourne. Whereas in Brisbane, things look a little less clear. And in Adelaide, prices are still falling. Perth is one area where prices are definitely not yet recovering. And the five cities average is just a little higher, but is still very much in negative territory over the last 12 months. And as I always do, I just want to remind you that these are averages and there are considerable differences at individual postcode levels. And here are just a few examples of postcodes where prices have moved considerably. So we can see that in Yarraville in Victoria at 3013, prices over the last year for houses have dropped 13.3%. In Montmorency in Victoria, 3094, prices for houses have dropped 8.2% over the last year. In Eltham in Victoria at 3095, prices are down 10.2% over the last 12 months. And at McLeod in Victoria at 3085, prices for houses are down 7.9%. So once again, this underscores the fact that individual areas and individual types of properties are moving quite differently from the averages that are often quoted. And so do the markets. The ASX closed at 5,617, down 0.31% on the day, and down 0.27% across the week. The ASX Financials Index was down 0.4% on Friday to 6,454. ANZ was down 0.79% to 2780. Their mortgage book shrank in the month, according to the APRA data. CBA was up 82.18, down 0.05%, and now fell 0.45% to 28.51. And they said this week that 13,000 customers had been contacted after a data breach where personal data was uploaded without permission to two data services companies. The breach was not a cyber security issue. No login details or passwords were compromised. The issue was human error and in a breach of NAB's data security policies. The breach comes a week after NAB hired Ross McEwan, the man credited with turning around Royal Bank of Scotland as its new chief executive officer. It hopes to win back customer trust after damaging findings in a public inquiry into the financial sector. The lender said that it had told regulators about the incident, including the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner. Westpac was 0.07% higher to close at 28.93. And one other highlight was Genworth, the lender mortgage insurer, which was up 1.52% on the first half 19 results. They were up 13.8% across the week thanks to continued share buybacks, but they reported continued lifts in mortgage delinquencies in Western Australia and Queensland. As a bellwether for mortgage performance, this does not bode well ahead. The Aussie US dollar was down just a little on Friday to 68.19, but fell 3.26% over the past month, thanks to weaker economic news here and a stronger US dollar. The stronger US dollar also lifted the gold Aussie cross, reaching 2,132, up 3.21% over the week, and the Aussie Bitcoin cross stood at 15,667, up 0.82%. and up 7.38% across the week. Volatile or what? So there are many centres of chaos across the market at the moment, and as a result, we expect to see more rate cuts from central banks ahead. And that said, we expect the RBA to hold on when they meet on Tuesday, but they will have to cut down the track. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.